You're probably going to be tired of this, but I do want to mention one more, and for the last time, that simple deductive argument about Messiah. I've got it there, right? Because this is the underlying issue in the Gospel of Luke chapter 24. And the underlying deductive argument that the disciples, all the disciples, not just the two that went to Emmaus, have to deal with is that Messiah cannot die. That's premise one. Premise two, Jesus is dead, and therefore the conclusion has to be Jesus cannot have been the Messiah. And this is a problem for Jesus' disciples. And in fact, it's a problem for all Jewish believers in the ancient world. And it's true today. It's the main problem for many Jews in coming to terms with Christianity. Messiah cannot die. Because the Messiah was the anointed one of God. That's literally what Messiah means, the anointed one. He was to be God's divine messenger and the deliverer of God's people. How could he die? And yet the one incontrovertible fact about Jesus is that he died. And he died a rather humiliating and ignoble death. On a cross, crucified by heathen and despotic people, bad enough that the Messiah dies, but he dies in the most horrible way humanly possible. See, crucifixion in the ancient world was the most reviled form of punishment and death. You know, today we have a cross here, an empty cross. It's become a symbol for eternal life, but in the ancient world, it was the symbol of a heinous death, of a God-forsaken death. Crucifixion was meant not only to kill a person, but to destroy them personally, socially, morally, to destroy their cause as well in the most humiliating and complete way. And at the time of Jesus, this would have been a big conundrum for Jews. How could Messiah die on a cross of all places? How could that even be possible? It makes no sense. It's not how it's supposed to be. It cannot be. And you know, it's interesting that a resurrection doesn't quite rescue the situation either. It doesn't undo the fact that Messiah did die in the first place. A dying and rising Messiah doesn't automatically get those first disciples out of jail with their community around them. Jesus died, and that shouldn't have happened. At least according to common Jewish understanding, if Jesus was the Messiah, then death should not have found them. But it did, in a sense for them, case closed. And proclaiming a crucified and risen Messiah to the Jews is going to become a real headache for the earliest church. It's going to become a slog for them because it's going to run up against a core belief among the Jews. Messiah cannot die. And taking this message of a crucified and resurrected Jesus out into that bigger world, first to Jews living in Jerusalem and Judea, and then to Samaria, and then ultimately to all the Jews who have come to find themselves living in that vast Gentile heathen world, it's going to become a big headache for them to deal with. In fact, Paul puts it kind of quaintly in his first letter to the Corinthians. He says, I've got a slide there for you. We preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to the Jews. A stumbling block is a bit of an understatement by Paul. It's a huge problem for them. An enormous obstruction to having this message taken seriously by the Jewish people throughout the Roman Empire and beyond. And the problem isn't going to become any easier with the Gentiles either. A crucified and risen Jesus was a big problem for Gentiles too. If for somewhat different reasons. See, amongst most Gentiles, the basic understanding around life and death was to find release from the body. The body is a true hindrance at all times, possibly a necessary staging ground for the next step along the way in life, but the body itself was an impediment to the fullest expression of human potential, and getting rid of it, escaping from it, was considered a good thing. The idea that God would come to us in a body in the first place is kind of ridiculous to many Gentiles, to the Gentile way of thinking, especially a body that can be destroyed. The idea of a resurrection of a body, that Jesus would be standing again in front of his disciples in a bodily form, would have been absurd to most first century Gentiles. For many Gentiles in the ancient Mediterranean world, Jesus being resurrected seemed almost like a step backwards. However, Jesus got released from his body. Having done so, why would he ever want to come back into it again? Considering that the physical world is ultimately a place of pain and death, if he really was a messenger sent by God, why would he ever want to be constrained again by flesh? It makes no sense. And we pick up the sentiment also in 1 Corinthians 1:23. Paul says, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles." And we tend to think that believing in the resurrection of Jesus is a modern problem. It's a modern challenge, but it was a huge challenge in the ancient world too. First, you have the preponderant fact that dead bodies stay dead, which was both an ancient and a modern truth. It's one of the basic links between the ancient and modern world. There are great differences between the today and what happened long ago, but the one place of agreement was that once dead, always dead. Beyond this basic fact of death, the early church ran into a wall with both Jews and Gentiles for differing reasons when they proclaimed Jesus Christ crucified and raised from the dead. And if they were making up this whole thing, if they were going to make up this whole story from scratch or to be free and loose with the facts themselves, the last thing that you'd want to do is construct something like a crucifixion and a resurrection. Why would you make your message the hardest sell possible? That makes no sense either. Much better to have some kind of vision of Jesus. Both Jews and Gentiles could have understood that. Some kind of powerful post-death vision of Jesus. Jews and Gentiles could have handled that. That would have been a familiar kind of message for them. It would have been a much easier sell to people, too. Jews commonly had visions of prophets of old. Great leaders of the Gentiles were often understood to have ascended into the heavens to live with the gods. The story of Jesus along this line of thinking would have made the earliest church's marketing program much easier. This is the kind of story you would concoct if you were making it up, making up those basic facts of a post-death reality of Jesus. You could just concoct your own story. This is what you would do. You'd have an easy vision to sell to people of the first century. You'd talk about Jesus getting translated from the grave up into the heavens to be with God, and they'd be over with. Done. Problem solved. So why didn't the earliest Christians take this approach? I mean, they were obviously powerfully impacted by Jesus. They wanted his message and his vision to go forward. Why did they proclaim something so difficult and so radically dissimilar to common understandings, something that was so hard for so many people to accept or even to get their head around? Because they went onto that rough and tumble world of the first century. And they proclaimed Jesus Christ crucified and raised from the dead, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. They proclaim Jesus raised up in the here and now, not sometime in the future, nor in some non-material, non-physical way. They proclaim a Jesus Christ resurrected in a real body. That's what the first Christians did. Now, in the Gospel of Luke, and Doug reminded us, we're still on Easter, 5-6 weeks into the Easter season. We're still actually in the Gospel of Luke on Easter Day. Jesus has been quite busy, hasn't he? Easter morning begins with several women who are going to the tomb to prepare Jesus' body for burial. But when they arrive, they discover that the big boulder that's been covering the tomb entrance has been rolled back, and they look in, and Jesus' body is gone. The tomb is empty. And while the women are trying to figure out what happened, two heavenly messengers, angels, we might say, appeared to them. And they told the women that Jesus was not to be found amongst the dead, but that he was alive. And they explained to them that this whole ordeal was a necessary rite of passage for the Messiah. and the women, they rush back to where the home base of all the disciples was, and they share what they have seen and heard with the bigger grouping of disciples, and it's dismissed as fantasy, as an idle tale, probably as some kind of post-traumatic hallucination. Nonetheless, Peter goes and investigates, and he finds things pretty much as the women related to them. And amazed, he heads back to base camp. It's about this time that two of Jesus' disciples leave Jerusalem and head back home to Emmaus. And as they are walking to Emmaus, a stranger comes up and begins to walk with them. The three of them begin talking about the events surrounding Jesus that had occurred over the past few days. The disciples cannot get around this simple deductive truth. Messiah cannot die, but Jesus died. We thought he was the Messiah, but obviously we were wrong. And yet the stranger instructs them in great detail that the Messiah can die, even must die. And when they arrive in Emmaus, the three of them share a meal together. And at this meal, the two disciples finally discover that the stranger is Jesus. They had been walking with the Lord the whole way. And in that moment, Jesus disappears. The two disciples head back to Jerusalem, and when they get back to Jerusalem, they gather with the broader community of disciples, and they find them in a very agitated state. Peter has met the Lord post-death. And then the two disciples who went to Emmaus begin relating their own story. And while they're all conversing back and forth about this, Jesus appears to them. To the 11, the 12 minus Judas, and to that broader community that had gathered with the 11. And he says to them, "Peace be with you." Luke relates that as a group, the disciples were startled and frightened. Disciples think they're seeing a ghost or some kind of supernormal manifestation. Jesus tries to calm them down. "Why are you troubled? Why do your doubts rise in your minds?" I think if Jesus showed up today in a tangible way to us, I think we'd be pretty rattled. What do you think? If he revealed himself here at Trillium in some tangible way, I think we'd all be pretty freaked out by it. Even though most of us know the story, we have hindsight as an advantage over those first disciples. Many of us believe this story too. We do think Jesus was raised into a new life in a tangible way. We have lived with these facts for a long time. We've come to know what to expect. We know the Easter stories. Many of us have heard them told every year at Easter again and again and again. We've sung the Easter songs and hymns again and again and again. And yet if the Lord showed up to us today in a tangible way, if he showed himself in a very tangible way, it would blow our minds. It is true after all. Wow, isn't that amazing? I think it would completely overturn our sensibilities about life, about death, about life after death. I think in a moment like this would overturn our priorities too. But for those first disciples, this is an epoch-changing moment for them. They have been slowly prepared on Easter Day. They've been slowly prepared. New seeds of new understanding have been planted in their minds and in their hearts. And yet, I suppose that's really no preparation for a moment of this staggering dimension. But clues have been dropped to them, and they are starting to believe. When Jesus reveals himself, he immediately has to start assuaging their fears. "Look at my hands and my feet," presumably the scars, the hurts that have been healed over or that mark him out as Jesus. "Touch me and see, a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have." This is an impassioned cry of Jesus to his disciples. "Look at me, see me, touch me, feel me. You don't need to be afraid. I am a real person in a real body." You see, resurrection means literally to stand again. The word in Greek is anistemi. Histemi is to stand. It's a very, very common word. Just like in English, in Greek, histemi is a very common word. And anistemi means stand again. The ana means a second time or again. You get knocked over in life? Something bowls you over or something knocks you down, literally or figuratively? and you stand up on your feet again, that is anistemi. If something gets knocked over and you put it back upright, that is anistemi. Very common word in the ancient world. Jesus got knocked down for real. Some people thought he'd been knocked down for good too. Death does that to you, doesn't it? But there he is standing again in front of his disciples. Not as a ghost or as a specter or some kind of apparition, but as a real, tangible person. He shows them his hand and feet, and yet they still can't take it in. They don't believe. It's impossible. They're filled with an incomprehensible joy and amazement, but it's just too much for them. And I can understand this. Can you? Jesus asks them if they have anything for him to eat. He's got to settle this one way or another. And he looks around, asks them if they have anything to eat. It's because ghosts and apparitions and specters, they don't eat real food. So they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. And that probably cinched the deal for them. Let me ask you this question again. Why did the earliest church go out into the world with a message that was a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness for the Gentiles? They took the hardest message out into the world that they could. They made this message of a crucified and resurrected Messiah the core feature of their message, their proclamation to the world around them. Became a banner that they waved in front of the world. Paul says, we proclaim Christ crucified. Why did the church take this hard message out into the world that would create such a headache for themselves? And for me, the only rational explanation is that they did this because that's what happened. That's how it went down. Jesus did stand before them again. He stood before them in a recognizable, tangible, substantial, perceptible, obvious, conspicuous way. And there was no way for the earliest church to deny this truth. There was no way for them to soft pedal it, or to rationalize it, or to dismiss it away. They were stuck with it. For better or worse, they were stuck with this difficult truth. And there wasn't much they could do about it. This was simply a headache they would have to deal with. And if others experienced it as a stumbling block or as foolishness, then so be it. Maybe not the best marketing strategy, but what could they do? But why would you want to turn away from this basic message anyway? Why would you want to water down something as amazing as this? Honestly, if Jesus did tangibly rise from the dead, and if he really stood before those first disciples again, standing again, if he was an embodiment of resurrection before them, then this is the most incredible, joyful, impactful moment imaginable. And think about its implications. Jesus rising from the dead. It means that there really is a God. We kind of sort of suppose there's a God, but Jesus standing in front of us back in the time of those first disciples, or if Jesus was standing before us, wow, there really is a God after all. We believe it, but there's something different when we see it before us. That's a big reveal in that moment for the disciples, because only God could bring someone who back from the dead, someone who was really dead. Only God could bring someone who was truly dead back to life. So there would be a God. And Jesus standing before his disciples means that Jesus was what he claimed to be. God had vindicated Jesus before the world. The world crucified Jesus, but there is God overcoming the contempt of the world by raising him to new life. Jesus standing before his disciples means that there's something beyond this world that's real and enduring, and that God ultimately has sovereignty over this world. And as crazy as it can get at times, and there's a lot of craziness in the world today, God's will ultimately prevail. And that means truly that love is greater than hatred. And forgiveness really is greater than revenge. God, Jesus standing again before his disciples tells us something about who God is. Reveals something of the nature of God. Shows us that God, what God's real intention for us is. See, God reconciles the sin of the world to himself and frees us to live in the bounds of perfect love. The resurrection of Jesus is understood by the earliest church as the beginning of a new creation in which God will come to live within us as spirit, as the full expression of the spirit of love. See, because Jesus isn't quite done with us yet. Luke ends his gospel this way. He says this, and I got a couple slides for you there. Then he, Jesus, opened their minds so that they could understand the scriptures. Jesus told them, this is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witness of these things, and I'm going to send you what my Father has promised, but stay in the city until you've been clothed with power from on high. See, Jesus isn't done with his disciples yet. The resurrection is actually a means, not an end. It's just the beginning with them. Jesus is just beginning truly with them. What's going on in the gospel, their discipleship with him, is a preliminary to what he's going to do with them. And I think Jesus isn't done with us here at Trillium either. In fact, I think he's just getting going with us. You and me. And if we find that the world treats our proclamation here at Trillium, Christ crucified, Christ raised from the dead, if the world treats our proclamation as a stumbling block or as plain foolishness, know that we are in good company.